Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
How Ben Bernanke knows what he knows. How your can of soup gets made, the can, not the soup. And as always in politics, follow the money. Super PACs that never die. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Investing, renting, sending your kid to college? Listen to the Marketplace Money Podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Good to have you here on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 7th of February, and we will start today with this. It's a can of soup. Campbell's tomato, to be precise. Why, you ask? Well, because that can doesn't just make itself, you know. And the tale of how the metal from which it's made gets from the ground to your supermarket is the corporate story of the day. Xstrata, it's an Anglo-Swiss mining company, and Glencore, a major commodities trading company, announced a merger today. The resulting $90 billion conglomerate would be the largest producer of coal and zinc in the world, not to mention owning a pretty serious share of the global supply of copper and lead, which means that that soup can, the merged company will have pulled the ore out of the ground, refined it, sold it, and processed it, and delivered it to Campbell's. We sent Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith off to find out what that means for you and for me and for the can of soup.
Xstrata pulls stuff out of the ground. Glencore sells it. The combo would be a kind of soup-to-nuts commodity shop. Economist Paul Robinson with IHS explains.
You've now got a company that mines the material, that refines the material, and that trades the material, which would be unique among the major players in the mining industry.
The company would control 30% of the coal used in power plants and 25% of the global zinc market. Zinc is used in making steel.
When you see a big merger like this, the fear is that they would consolidate too much supply.
So the company could corner the market, jack up prices, and suddenly, no more dollar soup for you. Rod Eggerts is a professor of economics at the Colorado School of Mines. He says lots of different companies could be affected.
The buyers of raw material input into a can, many construction projects now which rely on steel and copper and wiring, or communities are building highway systems or railroads.
And those costs have a funny way of trickling down to soup consumers. Still, before you run out and stockpile, Eggert says even this giant probably isn't big enough to have much control over prices. And the companies say they can streamline and cut costs, so maybe the soup I'm heating up would get cheaper. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace. Ooh, that's hot.
Ben Bernanke made another of his semi-regular schleps up to Capitol Hill today. There was much interest among members of Congress about how the economy's doing and when interest rates might finally begin to rise. The Fed chairman said the economy won't be healthy enough to do that until 2014. But how does he know? Here's Heidi Moore.
Spoiler alert, he doesn't. He's guessing.
It's important to realize that the Federal Reserve cannot see the future any better than anybody else.
That's Milton Israti, the chief economist for Lord Abbott. He concedes it's not easy to be an economic oracle these days. There are a lot of ways to measure the economy's positive trajectory. There's manufacturing, consumer sentiment, GDP. They're all looking up. But a lot of houses are empty and millions of people are still out of work.
It is not a robust recovery.
Alan Levinson is the chief economist for T. Rowe Price.
We had the deepest recession since World War II, and we're in basically the weakest recovery since then.
Bernanke's job is to keep prices low and employment high. He says he doesn't favor one over the other, but obviously one of them tends to attract more attention.
Since inflation is at a satisfactory rate, not too high, not too low, he can focus on employment. So yes, right now that's his priority.
Unemployment is at 8.3%, and Bernanke wants to knock off another few points. That's unlikely to happen before, yes, you guessed it, 2014. Israti says Bernanke isn't the only one trying to figure out what's going on.
We're all guessing, and there's never enough data. That's true.
That doesn't keep us from treating Bernanke as an oracle anyway. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Colorado and Minnesota are holding GOP caucuses tonight. Missouri held a non-binding Republican primary today. But you know what? They're not actually the political stories of the day. That comes to us courtesy of the Obama 2012 reelection campaign, which, in a change of heart, says it is now going to start encouraging donors to give to a super PAC that supports the president. Super PACs are all the rage this year. Unlimited donations, unlimited expenditures. But since there are only going to be two major party candidates left standing when the primaries are done, President Obama and somebody from the GOP side, it does seem reasonable to ask this question. What did the super PACs that supported the losers do with all the money they raised? Well, it turns out super PACs don't automatically die. They are, you might say, undead. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has the details.
They become known as zombie PACs, super PACs whose candidates pull out of a race. For campaign finance reformers, they're worse than any scary movie.
An experience more shattering than your strangest nightmare.
There are absolutely no rules on what the zombie super PACs can spend their leftover money on. Paul Ryan is an attorney at the Campaign Legal Center.
It is perfectly legal for the folks running a super PAC to take any money in the coffers of that PAC to buy a yacht and to sail off into the sunset if they chose to do so.
The zombie army includes Our Destiny, which supported John Huntsman, and the pro Rick Perry super PAC Make Us Great Again. And the army will grow as more candidates drop out.
Look up the road. There's a lot more of them. Oh, God.
And these zombies are loaded. Richard Berfault teaches campaign finance law at Columbia University. He says even after all the bills are paid, there will be substantial leftovers.
That could still be a couple $100,000. These are committees that raised in the millions.
Federal Election Commission records show the pro-Perry super PAC has more than $500,000 left. Donors don't officially have a say in where their cash leftovers go. But if Newt Gingrich were to quit, the pro-Gingrich super PAC would probably listen to Sheldon and Miriam Adelson, who contributed $10 million. Bob Biersack is with the Center for Responsive Politics.
And if they said, look, I want my money back, or I want something else to happen, it probably would behoove those folks to at least pay careful attention.
If they ever wanted to raise money again. When money talks, the zombie super PACs understand. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Not a whole lot of screaming on Wall Street today. They held pretty much steady as traders waited to see what happens over in Europe. Yeah, it's Greece again. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Shares of Citigroup have been holding steady the past couple of days, right around $33 or so dollars a piece. Nothing wrong with that, completely respectable, but somewhat detached from the news, I'd say. Like the possibility of Citi getting a couple of hundred million new customers. Because as of yesterday, it's the first foreign bank allowed to issue its own credit cards in China. The Chinese are no strangers to plastic. They've got debit cards all over the place. But credit? Oh, that's a whole different beast. Our Shanghai correspondent Rob Schmitz has the story.
Right now, only 6% of commercial transactions in China are made with a credit card. So the country seems like a golden opportunity for Citigroup. Its economy is growing, so is its consumer class. But on paper, Chinese consumers don't appear to be big spenders. On average, the Chinese save six times as much of their incomes as Americans do. China economist Andy Rothman says this raises an interesting question.
The trick is going to be how profitable is this going to be, because most people for a very long time, I think, are going to pay off in full their credit cards every month, and that's not really how the banks make money.
Here in Shanghai's shopping district, 30-year-old Yang Ran says she's scared of credit cards.
It's like spending other people's money. That makes me uncomfortable, and that's why I don't ever want one.
But if there's anyone who can restore hope for U.S. credit card companies in China, it's a consumer like 26-year-old Ni Peijun.
I have a credit card, but I don't like it very much. I'm always forgetting to pay my bill.
Mr. Ni says he likes how easy it is to buy things now, but he admits if there are more people out there who aren't paying their credit card bills, it could hurt the banks. It's a problem Citigroup has seen before, closer to home. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
You can quibble about the exact point where middle age begins. People on the younger side want to push it back. People on the older side want to hang on to it for a while. But the Census Bureau just does with the cold, hard numbers. There are in this country 81.5 million people between the ages of 45 and 64. And when you get that many people in one demographic with as much purchasing power as they have, oh, it's like printing money. And so over the years, an entire industry has been built with this one idea in mind. Here you go. It goes like this. Man, I wish I looked younger. Patricia Cohen reports for The New York Times. She is also the author of a new book called In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Patricia, good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You write about, for our purposes on this show, you write about this thing called the midlife industrial complex. What does that mean? It sounds so ominous.
Right. I know it does. I cribbed that phrase from the famous military industrial complex
Eisenhower
warned about. Exactly. But I thought it was appropriate because the word complex seemed to apply in two senses. One, the economic. It's this kind of sprawling trillion-dollar industry that has developed around middle age, all kinds of beauty aids to middle age empowerment gurus constantly bombarding us about things that we should buy for our middle age. But it also generates a complex in the emotional sense, like an insecurity complex, to make us feel bad about the normal signs of aging as if there's something deviant or diseased about getting older.
Well, and you give a great example, actually, with Clairol, the shampoo and the hair people. You quote a 1943 ad, and I love this one. 1943, Clairol says, quote, "Remember when rouge spelled hussy, when lipstick meant brazen, when nail polish branded you common?" And then they go on to say that basically nice women can color their hair as well. I just love that. It was great.
Exactly. And you can see that exact same narrative line, that storyline being told now about Botox. In fact, I do a kind of case study of Juvederm, which is made by the same company that makes Botox. They had two tennis stars that have become their spokeswomen. And one of the things they say is, well, I used to be embarrassed about telling my friends, but now I'm proud to say that I use Botox. And this is the same way of kind of destigmatizing this, saying it's normal to get Botox just like you would get your teeth fixed if you had a problem.
You actually pick up on what is a loaded historical and racially tinged term as well, passing. We are trying, those of us in middle age, a lot of us, are trying to pass as younger.
Well, it was just one of the things that struck me. In any other context, passing, whether you're black or whether it was gays when they were in the military, was either seen as justified in the sense that you lived in this repressive or discriminatory society. And so it was okay to fool the system to open opportunities that would not ordinarily be open to you. But when we're passing as young, we're congratulated as if we've accomplished some wonderful thing in fooling everybody that we're really younger than we are. And what I think that does is actually undermine middle age, because therefore all of the accomplishments of middle age, which are looking good or being creative, are instead credited to being younger.
Patricia Cohen, her book is called In Our Prime, The Invention of Middle Age. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, help wanted, a few good people to help drive down medical costs.
In the sociology literature, these people are referred to as natural helpers. They're the type of people that will be at a neighbor's bedside, whether they're being paid to or not.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gained 33 points today. That's 0.25%, closed at 12,878. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points, almost a 0.1%, 2904, an 11-year high if you're keeping track at home. The S&P 500 also put on 2 points, 0.2%, finished at 1347. Coca-Cola fizzled up 0.75%. Yum Brands ate up 2.5% in the gain column. The owner of KFC, Taco Bell, and Pizza Hut beat earnings estimates. McDonald's is expected to report big sales numbers tomorrow. The Golden Arches climbed nearly 1.5%. Gannett, the publisher of USA Today, rolled back 2.75%, but the company with the second largest circulation in America had good earnings. McClatchy rose 21%, largely because of increased advertising revenues. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.97%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for a good read? Visit the Big Book blog at marketplace.org. Listen to author interviews and read excerpts from the Marketplace bookshelf. Online at marketplace.org/thebigbook.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the National Rural Water Association holds its Great American Water Taste Test, assessing America's nuclear future. That's the topic at a hearing of the House Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. And he's currently up for an Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor for his performance in Warrior. Nick Nolte turns 71. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. So, coming soon to the skies near you, drones, unmanned, remotely piloted airplanes, military, commercial, and privately owned. The big aviation bill the House and Senate passed this week said the government has to open up all the skies to unmanned aircraft within the next 4 years. Marketplace's Adrian Hill has more.
Imagine you're walking. It's spring. It's the future.
Oh, honey, look at that hummingbird.
But it looks odd. Is that a camera?
Yes, my friends, it is a camera. It's a hummingbird-sized unmanned aircraft system, a UAS, a drone.
Ah!
Now calm down, it's not going to blast you, but it just might be taking your picture.
UAS were really created for specific missions. They're very good at collecting information and data.
Gretchen West is the executive VP of the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International. Yep, the drone industry has a trade organization. She says drones come in all sizes, from Hummingbird to 737, and there's all sorts of people who want them. Cops want them to track bad guys.
Real estate is one good example, so a real estate agent could use this for aerial photography.
Gas companies want them to monitor pipelines, insurance agents, farmers. It's easy to imagine a sky full of these things watching us.
It is freaky.
Jay Stanley is with the ACLU. He says the group is okay with some uses of drones.
We have no problem with, you know, industry making money off drones, but we think that before they become as common as swallows in the air over our skies, we need to put some good privacy protections in place.
Assuming the bill becomes law, the Federal Aviation Administration has to figure out where they can fly and who can fly them. The skies will open September 2015. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
You could try, but there probably aren't many issues on which you can draw a straight line from Richard Nixon to Barack Obama. But then you get to energy independence. It's been a goal of this country and every president since Nixon, since the Arab oil embargoes of the 1970s. And it looks like we're moving closer to it. The folks at Bloomberg have crunched the latest numbers from the government, and they say the U.S. is now 81% energy self-sufficient. We're talking energy for both transportation and electricity, just to be clear here. Sarah Gardner reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk. It is progress, though not a panacea.
If the U.S. is moving closer to energy independence, it's thanks in no small part to the boom in shale oil and natural gas. In fact, last year, we relied less on foreign oil than in any of the past 16 years. Experts say that's good news for national security, jobs, and the trade deficit. It also puts America on track to be world energy's big kahuna. Jamie Webster is senior manager at PFC Energy.
Because of the boom, largely in natural gas, but a bit in oil as well, by the time you get to 2020, we will actually be above Saudi Arabia, we will be above Russia, and we will be the number one producer on a, you know, country-by-country basis.
But Daniel Yergin says that won't totally protect us. He's author of The Quest, Energy, Security, and the Remaking of the Modern World. Yergin says when it comes to energy, we're all connected.
We're still going to be part of a global oil market where there's one price. And if something happens in the Persian Gulf, something happens with Iran or some other scenario, and it affects supplies and price of oil, you'll feel that everywhere, including the United States.
Critics say all this domestic production of fossil fuels has its downsides, like environmental risk. But natural gas prices are now so cheap, there's less incentive to invest in cleaner energy, like solar and wind. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
The list of reasons healthcare costs in this country are so high is a long one indeed, and we're not going to rehash all of them here. But we are going to highlight one that is, in most cases, totally avoidable: hospital readmissions. Say you're a senior citizen on Medicare and you go to the hospital. One out of every five times, that is 20% of the time, you're going to end up back in the hospital before a month is out. That obviously gets expensive in a hurry. So under the healthcare reform law, starting this October, hospitals with too many readmissions are going to get fined, which is forcing them to look at what's happening outside their own doors and to go beyond just doctors and nurses. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Gregory Warner has more.
When he came back home from Vietnam, Joe Francis discovered that all the money that he'd sent back home for his education had been spent by his mother. When he finally got his degree in engineering, and he was the first in his family to go to college, his mom said what she always said when he read a book or got a good grade.
She would use the expression, "You ain't doing nothing for showing off." And I never had her support.
When Joe Francis lost his job 5 years ago at age 56, he found himself completely alone, without family, estranged from his son, his brother and sister dead, and Joe, who's a lifetime smoker, became compulsive about the habit. He has emphysema and asthma, so when he smokes, his lungs spasm and he has to be rushed to the hospital.
I went to the emergency so much, the doctors knew my name. I said, "Mr. Francis, you're back again. You know you're killing yourself." And in the back of my mind, I wanted to. I would leave the hospital, I'll buy three packs of cigarettes and see how fast I'll smoke them up. I was literally trying to kill myself.
Did you know you were trying to kill yourself?
I did, because I knew before these three packs of cigarettes up, I'm going to call the EMT. I made sure that door was unlocked. I made it easier for them to get me.
If you were trying to kill yourself, why did you call the EMT?
Well, I didn't want to die alone.
All those hospital visits, oxygen tanks, the x-rays, the MRIs, the CAT scans, the Veterans Administration picked up the tab for all of it.
It cost them a lot.
Dr. Shreya Kangovi is an internist at the University of Pennsylvania Hospital. She says every doctor knows these patients.
We just focus on the medical issues and spend tens of thousands of dollars ordering MRIs, titrating every milligram of their blood pressure medications, and then on the day of discharge, bye-bye.
And that bye-bye costs taxpayers. Let's take Medicare, the government program for seniors. It spends $17 billion a year on patients that cycle in and out of the hospital more than once a month. And there's no incentive for hospitals to stop those patients from returning.
Hospitals have nothing to lose with readmissions. They are paid for admissions and keeping their hospital beds full.
Hospitals have always said there's nothing they can do to change how people behave once they leave the hospital. But starting this October, that excuse won't wash anymore. As part of the new healthcare law, hospitals will face hefty fines for allowing too many readmissions. At Penn, Dr. Kangovi launched a program that focuses on the five poorest zip codes in Philadelphia, those five zip codes responsible for 85% of readmissions in the city. That's how Mary White first met Joe Francis, the engineer we met before.
When I first met Mr. Francis, he was in Presbyterian Hospital. He was hooked up to oxygen, could barely breathe, could barely walk. So I introduced myself. I told him I was a community health worker.
A community health worker is not a nurse. It's not a home aide. It's defined as someone who has the same background as her clients. Mary White and Joe Francis are both Black. They both grew up in Philly. They're almost the same age. Both have had health problems. They could relate.
She said, "I'm going with you to your appointment." And she caught the bus. And I said, "Wow." She kept her word. When I got out of the hospital, you say, "Well, Joe, you're doing better. You're walking down the street like you're a young man." Remember you told me?
Yes, I remember.
And I said, "I actually have somebody standing by my side." And in my mind, I said, "I'm going to get well for you."
How long did you guys spend together working together?
About 2 weeks.
It was 2 weeks.
Within 2 weeks, Joe started going to a community senior center that Mary introduced him to. A month later, he was teaching classes there, one in drums, the other in computers. Those 2 weeks did what 6 years of therapy and no smoking programs and nicotine patches couldn't do.
Mary had a lot to do with me stop smoking. It was just her heart and the generosity she showed that gave me confidence in myself.
And Joe hasn't been back to the hospital since. Of course, not all of Mary's clients have such a radical transformation. Readmission is a complex problem rooted in poverty. But there is something about Mary. Here's Dr. Kangovi.
In the sociology literature, these people are referred to as natural helpers. They're the type of people that will be at a neighbor's bedside, whether they're being paid to or not.
So with Mary White, the morning that I met up with her, she'd woken up early just to cook breakfast for an injured neighbor.
So that was before work. So then I came.
A couple of days before, while waiting for her ride home from work,
you know, people watching after I got off on the job.
She spotted a woman with one leg, struggling to carry her suitcase and crutches. Mary helped her.
And so I filed her out to the car, and she said, thank you, that was very sweet. Then another lady, she looked like she was a stroke victim, and I said, do you need help walking to your car? So she, at first she said, no, I should be all right. And then she turned around, she says, I really could use that help. So I walked her out to her car, and that was just why I was waiting to go home myself. So that's the, you know, that's just a part of me.
The hope is you pay this kind of person to lower healthcare costs, you might actually get somewhere. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, which is a little bit zeitgeisty, but revealing in its own way. So the jobs numbers have been good lately, right? And there's a tad more optimism out there, maybe. We're feeling it, that's for sure. The Federal Reserve told us today that consumer borrowing rose in December. Not only that, it rose in November, too, which is good because a borrowing consumer is a confident consumer. But it's bad, too, because wages aren't up that much at all and people are still borrowing. And no, it can't just be straight good economic news. I don't think that's the way it works anymore. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow was up 33 points, 0.25%, closed to 12,878. The NASDAQ ticked up 2 points, almost a 10%, 2904. The S&P 500 also put on 2 points, 0.2%, finished at 1347. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Bead. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM. That's American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.